Hello, you're listening to Off the Jet, featuring stories of those who have gone on the JET program, an exchange program that has brought the world to experience life in Japan. I'm Eden Law, a JET alumni, and I run this podcast because I just love listening and talking to the JET community about their stories. So travel to another country to live and work can be life-changing. In this episode, I talk to Luke Curden, a professional musician, about the inspiration and creative community he found in Japan. We talk a bit about the music scene in Japan, and not to give any false hopes here, but how it can be possible to carve out a living doing your own thing as a working musician in the busy Tokyo scene. So without further ado, on to the episode. See you at the end.
Okay, my name is Luke Curden, and I did JET around 2014 from memory, and I was placed in Gifu-ken in Motosushi, which was very, very inaka and very interesting. And these days I'm back to my old job, which is being a professional musician.
Fun question I like to ask everyone is, tell us something about your JET home or placement that people should know about, whether it's something quirky, historical, off the beaten track.
If you're going to the onsen, you're gonna have a lot of Oji-chan penises in your face.
Awesome.
As the only gaijin in the town, they always find it very interesting when you get into the bath. And then, of course, because they want to talk to you, they get up and start barking something you don't understand. All very friendly, but they happen to do it kind of right here and standing up while you're sitting in the bath. So there's that. If you're a male on JET. I don't know if it's female JETs there, but there's that.
Yes, that brings back a lot of memories. I might have to put a content advisory warning on this podcast at the beginning. So 2014, actually, you're one of the first JETs I know who proved that there's no age limit on JET anymore. I know that when I went, there was an age limit of 40, but now that's gone now.
Yeah, well, I think I would have been 40. And I was always the oldest. Everywhere I went, amongst the other JETs, I was always the Oji-chan. There didn't seem to be any issue with that when I was interviewed or anything like that, or no one, you know, they were more interested in why I wanted to do JET and what I had to offer. I think being a bit older, you've got other things to offer in the role. Obviously, I can't generalize about everybody, but I think by virtue of having more life experience and more time to experience different cultures and things, you'd probably be a little bit more, I don't know, flexible, I would think, compared to some people. Or you're just more prepared for the unexpected.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah. A lot of my fellow JETs were in their early 20s, fresh out of university. And I've already been working for a number of years, so I was older than quite a lot of them. My nickname in the group was actually Dad, which, sort of dodgy for all sorts of reasons, I think. But I do relate to what you're saying about adaptability, because I think being an old JET, one advantage is that you don't maybe sweat the small things as much. So, you know, things happen. Having had a working experience, shit happens and things don't go your way. You just roll with it. So that is that adaptability to it. And I can see some advantage of being young too, because there's that sort of energy that they bring and sense of wonder and just, oh my God, this thing, oh my God, that thing. When I guess for me, it's been an older JET. I was a little bit more sort of jaded. Like, oh, okay. Well, that's cool. Well, I wonder how long that's going to last. You know, that sort of cynicism that I had underlying everything. So it's really cool from my perspective anyway to be around younger people who brought that sort of wide-eyed wonder to things.
You know, I enjoyed it. Yeah. I liked having, I sort of had a little sister staying in the, because they put all the JETs for the town in the one place. Mm-hmm. We're all in Kopo Ono, which is an old Oji-chan that owned this just row of units. She had the best Japanese of any of us, but she was just useless as far as basic life skills go. So it was kind of having a little sister living next door. And I kind of enjoyed it because I'm the youngest in my family.
So I want to talk about your career now. And you are a Correct me if I'm wrong, you're not a session musician. I know there's a difference, but I don't know that much because you have your own band. Is that correct?
I do, but I am a session musician basically, but session musician meant something completely different 15 years ago even. Basically most of my working life is playing live shows, and at the moment most of it's just covers gigs and tribute shows. But I do have my own band called Red Dragon Blues, and I write most of the music for that, which I started in Japan at someone else's idea. I met a drummer, a very successful session drummer in Tokyo, and he, I think I talked to you about him when we spoke before. He's half Austrian, half Japanese, and spoke like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was playing with, what are they called, SMAP, and some of those big boy bands and all that kind of
Oh
stuff,
my God.
and jazz bands, but big artists. What's the other girl's name? Super Groove or Super something, but famous, legit, big time famous artist over there. And he met me. He said, "Well, why don't you? Says you're going to start a band and you'll sing it." I'm, really? I'm more of a guitar player. He said, "You can sing. I've heard you. Let's. I'll play in it, and I'll get a kick-ass bass player." And that, so I did. And that's,
Wow.
and I wrote an album about my experience living in. Partly in Gifu and partly after when I moved to Tokyo afterwards. And it was easy to write because there's so much to write about. I continued it, but I don't gig it very often because you can't make money off your original music in Australia and it's just too much work. But I've gigged it a couple of times and now I use it more to collaborate with people. So the last album I did more collaborating, I got my friend, the singer who lives in Paris. But who's Australian, and I played another band called Kerytni with, which is a heavy metal band, and we used to tour around Europe. So I got him to guest on one of the songs, and he recorded his parts from home. And I did it. I was always getting friends and musician friends in Japan to collaborate with me as well. So one girl, a very, very popular bass player, Juna Sarita, and she is also hilarious because she never stops pouting. I think she's got three or four different versions of pout, and she's always wearing one of them. But she's hilarious, but also one of the best funk bass players I've ever heard, like anywhere.
Cool.
So yeah, so I do a bit of that, but basically I do lots of tribute shows, lots of covers gigs, solo acoustic gigs, and then sometimes I get big ones like I do. Last year we were doing Classic Rock Live, which was I think an 8-piece band and five singers and the full orchestra. And we do Guns N' Roses and Queen and the Eagles and all that kind of stuff. And next month I've got one which is also with an orchestra, which is Ziggy. So it's the songs of David Bowie.
Yeah.
And that one's at the State Theatre, which will be fun because it's that one. The singers are really cool. There's an old guy, Jeff Duff, who's Duffo must be in his 70s, and he knew David Bowie, and he was an old character from King's Cross. From back in the day, and there's another guy, Steve Balby, who is the bass player in Noiseworks, who were quite a big, massive band in the 80s and 90s, and another guy, Iota,
Yeah.
who he was big in the 90s, and he's incredible. He was kind of the Jeff Buckley voice of Sydney, and then he sort of did all these amazing things, and then he sort of disappeared for a while.
Yeah.
He was in Mad Max.
That's the guy with the
Yeah, flaming guitar on the front of the truck. That's
yeah.
him.
What did they call him? The Doof Warrior.
Yeah,
That's it.
right.
Yeah. His nickname's the Doof Warrior among the fans of the film. Yeah.
He is great. He is exceptional. He's so good. He drags up fully, and he's just, I don't know. He's one of those guys, performers that sort of seems to go into another character when he gets on stage and bam,
Yeah.
out he goes. He's great.
That's fantastic. And for all the foreign audience listeners, all two of you out there, we mentioned these are all well-known names in the Australian music scene. Very much part of my childhood growing up. Impressive. How did you get into music in the first place?
When I was little, I was the youngest. My older brother and sister listened to a lot of music, and we had just a balcony at the back. And then eventually, they closed it in and made it another room, and they put a big old record player in there. And basically, it was just records and a record player and a couch. So we sat in that room and listened to lots of music. And I don't know, I always loved it. And then when I was in at the early high school, I wanted to join the band. And they said I was going to play sax, and they said something about my teeth being too too manky. I don't know. And then a friend of mine who played bass and drums and other things and sang, he said, "Oh, I'm going to start a band. I need a guitar player." So I said, "All right, I'll do that." And I always loved hard rock and metal and all that kind of stuff and blues. So that's kind of how I started. I played my first gig in a pub when I was 17 at the Haunted Castle in Lewisham, which back then was a metal bar. And then after that, when I was at university, I played in some covers bands and stuff like that. And I started getting paid for it. And then I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll do that for better or worse. I've played in 10 countries. The best things I've done, the highlights were things like Hellfest, playing that with another band called Caritney, which I had part of, was one of the writers for the first few albums in that band. We did played with Kiss and Van Halen and Black Sabbath and Stone Temple Pilots and lots of those bands and a lot of other Lynyrd Skynyrd. Did I say Def Leppard? I think
you haven't said ZZ Top. Leppard. I would have remembered. Yeah.
Yeah, ZZ Top. So that was a highlight. When I lived in Tokyo, I did get some session work there, recording in a little studio out in Chiba. Every couple of weeks, I get a session out there, and I did some recording for that same guy the other day from my house here from Sydney.
How did Jet kind of fit into that?
I decided to go to Jet because I've been touring for 4 or 5 years with Shannon Noll.
Yes, and for our international listeners again, Shannon Noll was one of the early winners of the Australian version of the, what is it, Australian Idol?
The Voice.
The
No,
Voice.
It was Australian Idol. It was Australian.
There's been so many.
Yeah, I've been playing all around the country with him, and I kind of just got a bit tired, a bit tired of the whole thing. No sort of criticism of him, but just the people that you have to deal with, and just some of the rubbish that goes on around that whole touring and all that kind of stuff. And also I started feeling the ceiling is really low in Australia. There's only so high you can go in music. There's really not. I mean, I don't just say it considering all my colleagues, most of my colleagues are professional musicians. They do it full time, but there really is a low limit to how far you can go here. And I think when I was doing that, after a while, I kind of got sick of it, and I visited Japan and loved it so much. And then a friend who is half American, half Japanese, but a long-term Japan resident, his wife is Japanese. It was his idea. He said, "Dude, you should do JET. What's that? It's a teaching program that government takes care of you. It's better pay than everybody else is getting, and you get a good experience." He really sold it to me. He said, "You won't live in Tokyo, but you'll get a real Japan experience." And he was right. All the things he told me a lot more things than that, but he was right about basically everything. And so I thought, right, I'm kind of getting older. I should try something else before I'm too old to try it. So I just thought I'll apply. And I got in.
Yeah. So, how long were you there for?
Only 1 year.
Yeah.
I had planned in the back of my mind, I wanted to do 3 years because I thought that would be long enough to really have been ensconced in it and really had the full experience. And I thought maybe after 3 years, my Japanese would be good. But I kind of got ants in my pants after a year, and I missed playing a lot. I didn't miss all the stuff that went with it. I really felt at home in Japan, but I just wanted to be in a big city and I wanted to be in Tokyo. And I was happy to keep teaching, but I wanted to have the opportunity to play music too and explore that. So that was kind of why I left after a year. And then I came back to Australia briefly. I applied for a job at GABA. I got it and I went back and I hated that job.
What's GABA?
It's Eikawa. One of the most famous ones one of the most popular ones. So I met lots of really, really cool people in that, but wasn't a good job or good pay. But I did get to live in Tokyo and I did get to play music, and I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. So how easy was it to get into the music scene in Japan? Because I've spoken to a few past guests on this podcast about getting into entertainment adjacent or related industries. Like one was talking about the talent management industry.
Yeah.
Well, she wasn't a talent management herself. She was a concert gig promoter, but did say it has a lot of sort of rules and it can be a very hard industry to crack. So how was it for you?
Well, I found it easy. I mean, I don't think it's actually easy to do music or any of that kind of any sort of creative seat of the pants, sole contractor kind of job anywhere. But I thought it was 10 times easier in Japan than it is here. People are much more eager to make new connections and to meet new people. And I think that there's more to go around. It's a massive pond to swim in. It's more a dam, whereas here is a puddle. Just by the sheer population and volume of entertainment there compared to here, people don't seem to be as precious about the little piece of it that they've got. So here, my experience has always been that people are apprehensive about letting someone else in. They're afraid of losing something that they've got because the feeling is that there is of scarcity, that there's not that much here, which I think is true. But you miss out on a lot of things could happen more easily if people are a bit more open to connecting with new people here. But in Tokyo, I met that drummer through a music school that I taught guitar at a tiny bit, but only a little bit because at the time I had not zero Japanese, but not much. And it was an Australian guy's company. And he was a mutual friend of someone I'd played with in Australia years before that. And he connected me with him. And through him, he had this drummer at his school, and I got on well with him. And straight away, he liked how I played. And he was just, I'll put you up for gigs. And he did. But I couldn't get the big shows because I couldn't speak Japanese at the time. So if I'd had better Japanese, I probably would never have come back. I'd probably be there playing in Sekai no Owari or something. I know the drummer in that band too. I met the bass player from Gesu no Kuwami no Otome, and Gesu have a lot of other bands too, and they're big. And I just met him at a book launch and said, "Hey man, my wife and I watched you on Terrace House and we loved you and we already liked your band and all that." And I can still message him on Instagram and he'll answer me.
Wow. So it
You
sounds
know?
like there's a lack of ego.
Yeah.
The community is truly just sort of want to reach out and just work with other artists. Yeah. And you said it was easier for you to get into the scenery, but sometimes there is that kind of like not just a cultural barrier, but maybe some racial discrimination for some of us. But it sounds like you were just able to make connections just by the fact that you were a creative, they were a creative. So, hey, let's jam. I don't care who you are, where you're coming from.
Yeah, I didn't have I mean, there were times when I could sort of you could feel a bit of racism, but never kind of directly. No one treated me badly. I mean, I remember a guy basically told us off. We were shooting a music video around Tokyo, and we were in that little, it's in Shibuya, close to the station, and it's not that it's been refurbed or knocked down, but it used to be the little tiny mini Golden Guy kind of spot there, in line with the railway line, and there were signs everywhere, no filming, and we're filming, we're filming there, so we're doing the wrong thing, and the guy told
Was
us
on
off,
you. Yeah, that's
and
on
you
you.
know, and that's on me. I think the word that you mentioned, ego, is a really important word because there was a lack of that. There were more, if someone says, if you're talking to a famous bass player or drummer or whatever, and you say, "I play guitar," then I think they're more interested in, "Oh, okay, well, maybe he might know something I don't," or, "Cool, I've not played with someone from Australia before. Maybe it might be cool." I think Japanese people are more interested in making friends. There seems to be a theme, even in lots of anime, manga, TV shows. And when you hear bands or actors, etc., anyone get interviewed, that comes up a lot, making friends. So I just found it so easy. Even though my Japanese wasn't great, they'll still try. Sometimes you end up having some pretty hilarious, very poor conversations with people you don't know, but you're all laughing and having a good time trying to claw your way through it. I never felt people were standoffish. It was great.
Were you playing cover songs, or were you just also testing out new material?
I think the first gig I did was my band was Red Dragon Blues, and I think it was somewhere that was the onsen sort of place, Tami or somewhere like that. That one we played my songs that I wrote, plus one set of originals, one set of covers, and I did a few small kind of covers gigs and stuff around Tokyo, but I got more work there doing playing my original music and also recording people's original music, a couple of time little small time recordings for commercials. So I did one for one of the department stores, and that was to advertise a randoseru. They want you to write something, but they basically want you to directly rip off a song that they would use but would pay less
Okay.
for it, you know. So I got a few of those things too. I think there's more here for playing covers and getting paid for it than there is in Japan, but there's more, way more in Japan for actually playing new music or the original music and getting money for it.
Okay. I'm just going down that route, that sort of theme, and thinking about making a living as a musician in Tokyo, based on your experience and what you've told me. What's the sort of an ideal way of making money as a musician?
I think you sort of have to do the whole lot. My wife and I, who's Japanese, who I met in Japan, we're probably going back to Tokyo. And I kind of reached out to a couple of musician friends there. One of that drummer, Mike, who plays in Sekai no Owari, and he's Australian and he's a really good guy. And I messaged him, said, "Hey, man, have you got any tips before I come back about how to get back into the scene and all that?" And he said, "Usual stuff, go to all the jam nights," which is how I met him. I went to a jam night at the Pink Cow at Roppongi, which was recommended to me by the other drummer, the half Austrian guy. He said lots of guys that play, even the guy that plays drums in, what's the boy band, one of the biggest ones.
There's a few. There's MAP, there's
So yeah,
Arashi,
maybe Arashi or Johnny's or something like that.
one of the Johnny's bands.
So he said basically do that, go to all the jam nights, and there are lots of them all around Tokyo. And I'll contact the guy that I was recording for the other day that I used to do sessions for every couple of weeks. And he's not famous or anything. He gets work. And I'll do that. And I'm thinking of, before I go, I'm going to try and do some collaboration with a couple of people that I know, like Juno, that bass player. And then when I get there, I've already got a connection with not just with Juno, but with some of her friends and players. And that might help me out a bit. And I'm also looking at doing something where some of the big record companies, my understanding is that they have an in-house session guys. So they pay some guys a salary and they play, if they work for Sony, well, they'll play whatever Sony tells them to play.
Yeah,
I
for
think it's
anime
quite,
music, right? Yeah,
what's that?
soundtracks on movie soundtracks, yeah.
It could be, but I think it's quite restrictive. I did meet one guy in Tokyo again at a jam night, and he was a guitar player and he was literally doing that. But he didn't, it sounded like if you have your own music, you're going to give them a percentage of that too, even if they don't do anything for it.
Ooh.
So I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's something like that. But it's something that I could do for a couple of years or whatever, if I was lucky enough to get in, and you'll network and you'll end up doing other things. So we're going to try. And then if not, then I'll probably end up looking for an ALT job while I hopefully improve enough for touring artists to book me and not be worried about me not understanding them. I've got something to offer that not many other guys play, guitar players around like me, even in Tokyo. Whereas here, there's lots of guys around like me. So
Yeah.
I'll try I'll basically like the splatter gun, the Homer Simpson makeup shotgun approach to just do everything. Try everything
Yeah.
until something sticks. Yeah.
Yeah. Talking now about how you normally work as a sole trader here in Australia. I remember when we talked about some of the tougher on business side of things. What sort of skills would you need to have if you were a musician working for himself, trying to get gigs, just basically earn a living?
Being blunt when it comes to negotiating people that don't want to pay you, don't be insulting or say nasty things, or don't threaten people, but be blunt, blunt as hell. Try and be a bit smart about it. Put yourself in a situation where you give yourself a bit of leverage. For example, if someone doesn't want to pay for something, a gig previously, and then if you've got another gig booked with them, it's a good time to bring it up with them is a couple of days before that gig, when you can say, "Well, you can pay me what you owe me, and you pay me for that one in advance, or maybe I won't be there. Because then you've got a bit of leverage, and they don't want to have to put in the work to find someone else to replace you. So it's easier for them to just pay you. But the other skills, basically, I think now more than ever, having social skills is extremely important because people seem to have completely dropped that since COVID, and everyone's mental and hard to deal with. So people that are easy to get along with and are fun to be around when you're going to be stuck in a car together for 5 or 6 hours at a stretch, or you're going to share a room. And there's always stressful things. Everything's DIY here, really. You might be playing a gig and the PA is half working, or things go wrong. When they do, you have to be able to adapt and not make the situation worse by being obtuse, or I don't know, unhelpful, or just being a drama queen. You've got to be good to be around. It's almost as important as being good at playing.
In terms of getting people to pay up on time, you didn't really run into that problem in Tokyo or in Japan.
No. I think maybe once I did, but it was a really, really small time operator. He was pretty lame. But playing with him, I met some really cool guys and good players. But yeah, and that was for pittance, for $30 or something. So it was hardly even worth chasing the money. But yeah, you don't really have that much trouble with that here. You have trouble getting paid a fair amount quite often. But I don't often have to chase people too hard. And when you do, depends on who it is, how forceful you have to be. But
Yes, and so
yeah.
we won't go into any further details because once again, I do not want to get our guests into trouble. Going back to the music scene in Tokyo, I'm kind of curious just how busy is the music scene in Tokyo? I don't know anything about this.
Well, it's very, very busy. There's something on every night in Tokyo. There's especially around Shibuya and Shinjuku, and I think Ikebukuro has a lot of Visual K live houses. And there's, oh, what's the other place? Shimokitazawa has lots of live houses, but they're everywhere, all around Tokyo, even in the places that aren't famous as being live music locations. There's jam nights on every night somewhere. And there's live music on all the time. And most of the guys that are working musicians there are really, really busy. They're working their asses off playing. They're playing all the time. Pop music and metal is quite good too. There's a lot of all-girl metal bands, Bandmade and Bites and
Would you throw in baby metal, or is that another different genre?
yeah, baby metal's, it's a different kind of format, but it's a similar genre. And oh, I can't remember. It's one of my, I listen to them all the time. Nemophila. And they're all with record company backing. And I get the impression that they've kind of paid a retainer so that they just do that band and that's it. They don't go off and do arubaito on the days off. They're at home practicing and writing. Pop, they love pop. There's so much pop music. And there's the boy bands and idol groups and all that too. Which, even though idol groups most of the time are miming, sometimes they have a live band, depending on who they are. So I think there's a big appetite for most genres, again, by virtue of the population size. For example, if 5% of the population of New Zealand likes a certain genre, that's not that many people, really. But if 5% of the population in Japan does, that's a lot of people. So.
Yeah, you can make music for that particular people who buy your
I think
records, etc.
actually jazz and funk are really popular.
Interesting.
Yokohama is full of jazz clubs, especially.
Yeah. Well, one of the most internationally famous Japanese author. Oh God, the name escapes me now.
Not Murakami.
Best Murakami. There you go. Yeah, he's a jazz lover, and supposedly his books are influenced by his love of jazz as well. Why jazz?
Well, I think because most people that play jazz or are good at it have, it requires a high level of proficiency and, a lot of study and or practice. And culturally, I think Japanese really respect that kind of thing. When people are just an absolute master at one particular thing, it's highly regarded. and they to strive for those things too. So I think that's why the genres like jazz are so popular. It's a similar reason why metal is popular. Lots of metal guitar players there can play a billion miles an hour. There's no shortcut. I think that's why jazz is so popular.
Yeah, now, I don't know if it's possible considering there's such a huge variety in the music scene over there. But I'll ask this question anyway. Is there some kind of emerging musical trend or what sort of coming up now that you've never seen before?
I'm not really sure because I haven't lived there for a while, but I get the impression that K-pop is getting bigger and bigger in Japan overall, which would include Tokyo, of course. And the all-girl metal is huge. There seems to be lots of those bands and more coming up, and they're becoming more popular overseas.
So, would you just recommend someone who's curious to check out the music scene just randomly pick some place, go in?
Yeah, that's what I did. The first gig I saw in Tokyo was in Shibuya at a place called Star Lounge, I think, which is around Sentagai, but not on Sentagai. But and you know, I went in there and actually again, that was by fluke. That was also an all-girl metal band. I had no idea what was on there. I just walked past and went, oh, this is obviously a live house. And it was kind of rock. So I thought, cool. And I just went in and paid and bam, it was great. It was so much fun. But there's I guess just go to any live venue that you come across, and also if you're a player, then jam nights. There's just so many. They're all over the place.
Yeah, you mentioned the all-girl metal bands. I don't know the names, but I'm assuming anyway that in the West there are all-girl metal bands too.
Yeah,
But
there are.
is it much more prevalent in Japan?
I think so.
Yeah, how come there's like so many forming in Japan? And what is it about Japan that actually seems to be more open to female bands in the music genre? Because given it's a traditional male-dominated culture, it's interesting to me why there's so many female-only bands, and particularly in the metal band as well, metal genre.
Well, I mean, as in my infinite wisdom as a random male gaijin, I don't know, from all my female friends in Japan and my wife, the impression, and just from having lived there, it is sort of a bit male dominated still. Even my wife is a bit afraid of going back to Japan and having the feeling of if I'm 30, then companies won't hire me because they think I'm going to get pregnant and not don't want to work anymore. So there's still a bit of that expectation on women to kind of be, I don't know, traditional or whatever that means, but to fit into that societal mold, I suppose. But if they go out and do something crazy, join a punk band or a metal band, then they get to cut loose, they get to rebel against it.
Societal expectations, yeah.
Yeah, I think because I often tell people if they ask me about living in Japan, I'd say it's a land of harmless weird. And also, if people who have never been there or they're interested, but they don't know much about it, they always seem to make that assumption that, oh, but isn't it really strict? And they make it sound like it's this place jam-packed with rules and you're all a bunch of robots and have to do toe the line on everything. But what I'd say to those people is that it's not really that. You have to do certain things you just have to do things at the appropriate time and place. So, sure, everyone puts on their work clothes and their work persona, depending on what kind of industry you work in. If you're going to work in a normal office kind of environment, there's that, you've got to do some of that. But then at night, when they're not at work, they're free to do whatever they want. And usually, if they've got a weird hobby or want to do something crazy, there's somewhere they can do the same crazy thing with thousands of other people that have the same crazy, weird thing that they do. And they can do it somewhere. There's probably a club, what I mean? And it's all tickety-boo, and their boss the next day doesn't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's just like
So,
as long as you come to work and you perform, I d don't really care what you do in your private lives, kind of thing.
yeah.
Yeah, I guess is that kind of you said, as you said, is this sort of escapism, but also doing something that it's genre breaking, I suppose, but there's no real rules. My two
Yeah.
cents, as I'm just talking about my butt here, is that certain things that have been part of the Japanese culture for a very long time, say, I don't know, if we're talking about arts, kabuki or something like that, where it's very defined, the tradition is it tends to be male dominated whatsoever. So there's more resistance to anyone trying to change or break the rules. So change will happen slowly. But for something maybe sort of Western music or metal bands where there's no written rules about how it should be done, there's no tradition in Japan of how you should be doing things. So there's probably not as much resistance to, say, women wanting to form a music band and play together because, well, the rules haven't really been written yet. So sure, while everything's in flux, go for your life.
I think so. I think there's a bit of that in there for sure.
Yeah.
And that's that a lot of people, they love escapism. I think a lot of Japanese, especially people that work really hard. That's why there's those guys in your Yogi Park in rockabilly outfits throwing their cans like the rebels and then politely going and picking them up after they're finished. It's a bit of escapism. There's no rules.
Yeah.
It's cool.
There's, yeah, you said something before. There's a time and place for everything. And I was really struck by that when I saw for the first time in my school the graduation ceremony and how everyone was crying and everyone gets so overly emotional. And I'm probably the only one who didn't cry, I think. But it just was a very surprising thing to witness, particularly, as you said before, non-Japanese have this perception of the Japanese culture has been very, very emotionally suppressed and all that. Yes, there's a bit of that, but then when given the time and place where it's appropriate to do something, they just let loose
They go for it.
they go for it. They commit wholeheartedly to what it is like they're allowed to do. And you said that there's space for everybody to just be a harmless weirdo to indulge in their hobby. And probably with surprising lack of at least overt sort of judgment or things like that. As long as you get your other stuff, no one really cares about what you do in private. And in a way, I think the Western culture is more judgmental about that.
You're not hurting or disrupting anyone, so what do we care?
Yeah, exactly. Why should we be judging you for doing that stuff, sort of stuff?
I did have the experience that lots of crying, lots of those experiences, especially on JET. When I think it's maybe like an end of year party or something for the junior high that I was at, and which was heaps of fun, and you go to like a washoku kind of restaurant, and you have the traditional thing, and you sit in the big tatami room and all around the kind of big U-shaped table, and all the teachers are there, and they have games, they get up, do performances, and everybody is unbelievably drunk, and because they do move the teachers around the prefecture every few years, there's always someone leaving, so they'll be crying about that. There's always a bunch of crying. And then there's Nijikai and the maybe the third one as well. Yeah, they really cut loose. Really, really different from what they were like in, during the day in the teacher's room.
Like at the Christmas, like the Bonenkais. For me, it was a Bonenkai, like I had one teacher, I couldn't understand anything, but it was the visual effect. Visual jokes is just hilarious. One of my JTEs, he was dressed to head to toe, sort of a green bodysuit with like a hood on. And he had Christmas lights. He just basically wound it around himself and he put like a Christmas star on top. And then while he was up there and the MC was talking, he just kind of like quietly flipped the switch and the lights just started blinking on and off. And you could see he's barely holding it together because like he's about to lose character. But yeah, they know how to party. They really know how to party. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
I love I had lots of, I don't know, lots of really cool random experiences like that, especially on JET, because it is in the country. And I think I don't know, I suppose it's probably easier to go out and go nuts if you live in Tokyo, but in the countryside, it takes a little bit more planning. But I had lots of those experiences, and like really and random things. Like I might have told you previously, like one of the teachers that I became the closest friends to at the junior high school I taught at, Tatsumi Sensei. So he was like a yoga, kind of a yoga guy, but he was an Indian. He did Indian dance, him and his wife.
Wow.
And they're really good at it. They'd studied, they'd gone to India and studied. And they did like a performance in a French cafe in Motosu, you know, like it's a French cafe in the country, in the middle of nowhere in Japan, in rural Japan, with Japanese people doing Indian dancing. Like,
Random.
and it was great, but it was full of those sort of things.
Yeah.
I'm there, it was great. I really, yeah.
Actually, in my town, Iwaki, it's got one of the oldest, if not the oldest, theme park, the Hawaiian Spa Resort, which
Yeah.
started in the 19, I'm gonna say the 1970s or something like that.
Wow.
So it was all Hawaiian themed, and there was a movie that came out in 2016 about it, actually, about the when they started, how they started it, because they wanted to have dances as part of the entertainment, the hula dances and everything. But it was caused quite a bit of a scandal because they had to wear the big sort of grass skirts and the coconut bras, that
Yeah.
kind of stuff. So in other words, showing skin.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it's so in Fukushima, the Hawaiian Spa Resort does regular hula dances.
Right.
Yeah, just like yours was the Indian classical dance, mine
Yeah.
was with Hawaiian dancing. Japan, I love it.
Yeah.
We
I
love it. We
mean,
love Japan.
there's so yeah, so much of that.
Yeah.
But I some probably it's probably I'm not sure how connected it is, but something I do want to at least go on the record of saying about the that whole jet time is like just the hospitality of people. I don't know what if the experience would be the same in the in a big city or not, but certainly my experience in a small town was just the number of teachers or friends of teachers or friends of parents that just liked to hang out with the ALTs and like they just wanted to show you their town. And you know, people like, you know, one teacher took me and another one of the ALTs to, you know, to see like to the best places around Gifu to see the change of leaves in autumn. Someone else took me to this like Motosu has supposedly one of the oldest sakura trees in Japan. You know, things like we were taken to the cormorant fishing. That thing in they do in Gifu where they go down the river and they've tied the necks off these cormorant birds and the birds catch the fish, but they can't swallow it because their neck's tied off. And at the end, they put it in the fire covered in salt and you eat it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, all very regional specific things like that. And there's always someone that wants to show you those things. It's re really cool. I one thing I really like doing is I discovered besides the onsen, which besides all the old Ojichan Wangs, I love going there every time it snowed because it was a really particular thing to that area. But you know, and also another thing I discovered around that, I think it was not that far from the onsen, was like a farmer's market that they would have every, I think every weekend. And you go buy rice, and there's like 10 different varieties of rice. And it's not washed or something yet. I don't understand the process, but it's not finished. It's not white yet. So you go and order whatever, a kilo or 2 kilos or whatever of the type you want. And then they give you a ticket and you wait for 10 minutes or something. And then they call out your number after they've washed it and
Yeah.
bagged it up and all that. So it's like the most fresh, straight from the farm, just across the way. Little things like that I really, really enjoyed. That was really cool.
Yeah. It sounds like a Japan, it sounds like the whole Japanese experience is like a really fertile ground for inspiration for you writing, because you wrote an album. Was that your first album you wrote?
It's the first one that I wrote by myself. I'd written with other people in other bands before, but it's the first time I wrote like my own album, basically by myself. I collaborated with one, a friend who is a sound designer at Sony Games in Tokyo. So one song I collaborated with him, and another girl kind of did some improv vocals on it. And she was American and really talented. But beyond that, I basically wrote that. It's the first time I wrote a whole album on my own and mixed it, engineered it, did the whole lot.
Yeah, I can see why you want to go back there.
It is very, very inspiring.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned before, the lack of ego. I'm not trying to paint a bad picture of what Australians are like, especially musicians. Most musicians here are nice people, and usually pretty tolerant of weirdness. I can't remember the quote from Anthony Bourdain about kitchens where crazies go to live, and like music's a little bit similar. I think if you can't be unusual in the music industry, if you can't be a bit of a weirdo, then where can you go? Musicians here are usually really nice people, but there's something about in Japan, there's that lack of ego and just eagerness to learn new things and to connect with other people and to make friends. Really, it's just so good to be around that.
Many thanks to Luke for taking out time from his busy schedule. Hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you're a Jet with a story to tell, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out to me at webmaster@jetaainternational.org. Until then, speak to you next time. Bye bye. Music for this episode is Mount Fuji by Bruce Arrizabalaga Quintet, used under a CCO public domain license. The AfterJet podcast is generously supported by the Council of Local Authorities for International Relations, but is otherwise an independent personal project by me. All views and opinions on this podcast are the personal opinions expressed by participants and have no connection with, nor do they reflect any official standing of any organization that the participants may be part of.